Hello there again, and welcome to Musings on Golf, where you'll hear great storytelling in this episode from one of the great swingers of the golf club and five-time PGA Tour winner Tom Pertzer. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my good friend Bob Bupka. Bob, we also have got some Ryder Cup stories to talk about. We've got the FedEx Cup fall beginning with the Fortinet Championship this weekend out in Northern California. And we even have a new logo to talk about. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great, and I'm very excited about that new logo for the PGA of America. There's been so much confusion for too long, especially on the TV networks. When they were referring to the PGA Tour, they would just say the PGA, and, you know, they're two completely different organizations. But now, hopefully, with this new logo, which we'll talk about later in this show, we can get some clarity for the PGA of America. They certainly deserve it.
I agree with that, and it'll be tied in with the Ryder Cup, which, Bob, heck, we're just a couple weeks out from the Ryder Cup. We've got the Solheim Cup, by the way, next week in Spain, and then the much-discussed Ryder Cup in 2 weeks in Rome. Speaking of, I liked a lot what I saw with the U.S. team going over and playing at Marco Simon last week, a golf course that really is unfamiliar to them. I think anytime you have trips like that, in this case with the 12 players, six of whom earned their spots, six of whom Zach Johnson selected, is good for team morale, and it certainly is good for getting to know the golf course and getting a sense of pairings, who's going to play with who in the most effective ways to try to break that 30-year jinx that the U.S. has had in Europe.
Well, Kelly, you know as well as I do, it's going to be a monumental task, to say the least. Quite frankly, the 12 players on the European side versus the 12 players on the U.S. side, right now, I think the European side is stronger. But that doesn't mean anything. You know, momentum in Ryder Cup. You know, you start out well on day one. It carries over to day two, and then you ride that momentum into the singles matches. And you come away with bringing that Ryder Cup home, which is not going to be easy. You know, last time, 1993.
Yeah, and I see where, you know, for Rory McIlroy, he had great partners for years in Sergio Garcia and Ian Poulter, neither of whom, for obvious reasons, are going to be part of the Ryder Cup this year. Sounds like Shane Lowry and Rory are going to team up. I think you've got two real classy guys, terrific players, and I think they'll form a good team. U.S. teams, you know, you got Xander Schauffele and Patrick Cantlay, Scottie Scheffler, Sam Burns, and Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, I think are kind of three. Where does Brooks Koepka fit in? Who does he team up with? Those, I think, are those are the things that the captain is going to have to do a great job, and he's going to look at all kinds of metrics. He's going to look at all kinds of personalities. This is a, you know, anytime, as I said, you get your guys together and do it in advance. So once they get over there, and there's going to be a heck of a lot of hoopla, Bob, when they arrive, it's good to have done this, or, you know, in advance for sure.
Oh, no doubt about that, Kelly. And I got a lot of faith in Zach Johnson. Yeah. He deeply wants to win, but every Ryder Cup captain wants to win. As I've said on previous shows, I'm just hoping that the losing captain doesn't come out with the reason why, being that the other team made more putts. That's what golf's all about.
I know that Rory McIlroy does not want to play at Marco Simon the way he did the final round at the K Club on Sunday. Hit the ball in the water four times and cost him a chance at winning his second Irish Open. Nonetheless, we do have a return, Bob, as I mentioned at the start, of what's called the FedEx Fall, the Fortinet Championship out in Northern California. Max Homa, who's on the U.S. Ryder Cup team, is the defending champion. Justin Thomas, who you and many others have questioned why he even is on the team, is going to be playing out there. He certainly needs to play, and he needs to play well, Bob. This is an important showing, I think, for Justin.
Yeah, and I think Justin has enough talent, Kelly, to actually win that event, and then he'll be going to Italy brimming with confidence. So everything right now kind of hanging in the balance, as they say. Only the tail of the tape will give us the story.
I also want to, before we get back into the PGA of America logo, I want to congratulate Lauren Olivares Leon of NC State University. She made college golf history, first woman to shoot 60 in a competitive round. She did so at Yeaman's Hall Club in Charleston, the opening round last week of the Cougar Classic. Sounds like a Bob Bupka round, 13 birdies and 2 bogeys. That's pretty good. So she's the first woman to shoot 60. There have been 17 men who have shot 60 in collegiate events. Bright future ahead for this young lady. She's a junior from Mexico.
Yeah, sounds like a surefire star in a couple of years on the LPGA Tour.
No question. We talked about that PGA of America logo, which you will in all likelihood see debuted at the Ryder Cup. It's the PGA of America runs the Ryder Cup completely when it's played here in the States. They partner with Ryder Cup Europe when it's played over in Europe, as it will be in Rome. Golf is unique, and the PGA is unique, Bob, in those letters. It becomes almost a generic, if you will, kind of like Band-Aid is for bandages. But the PGA name is very confused between the PGA Tour and the PGA of America. And the PGA of America and its leaders, and I think wisely so, have done everything they can to make sure that the consumers, the media, anyone with any kind of interest in the game of golf understands there is a big difference between the PGA of America and its 28,000 golf professionals and the PGA Tour and its touring professionals.
Yeah, well said, Kelly. And I think this new logo is going to establish some criteria that's going to make it easier for everybody to identify between the two organizations, because in reality, they couldn't be more different.
Well, you mentioned about identifying. Sports Illustrated identified 17 of the prettiest golf swings to ever grace our game. And Tom Pertzer, who you'll hear from in a minute, is among those 17. Tom won 5 times on the PGA Tour. I'm sure he would have liked to have won more. But, man, I remember watching him, Bob, back in the late 70s and into the 80s. Nobody swung the golf club as beautifully and as smoothly, and he talked a lot about tempo and rhythm as Tom Pertzer.
Yeah, absolutely. I often thought that there were a lot of similarities between Ernie Els and Tom Pertzer, where they don't seem to be exerting a lot of effort, but certainly hit the golf ball a long way. And one thing about Tom Pertzer that I'll say, he was a great golfer, had a great career, but I think he's even a nicer person and a wonderful ambassador for the sport of golf.
And you'll hear from Tom Pertzer, the interview that Bob and I did with him, right after this.
When you make the best performing golf balls in the world, your biggest competition is yourself. And now the golf ball that sets the standard for every other has raised the bar again. New Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob, a great golf swing is something that I think all of us strive to find. In the case of our guest today, he certainly found it as he ranks among Sports Illustrated's list of the 17 prettiest golf swings of all time. He won 5 times on the PGA Tour, 15 times as a professional. Really looking forward to catching up with Tom Pertzer. Tom, welcome to Musings on Golf. How are you?
Hey, Kelly. I'm doing great. How are you doing, Bob?
I'm doing great. And you don't know this, Tom, but quite often when I had the opportunity and you were on the range, I would stand, 50, 60 yards away and truthfully marvel at how smooth your swing was. I said, how can he hit the ball that well, swinging that smooth? You're one of the best I ever saw out there, and, I've been out there quite a while.
Yeah, I remember seeing you out there, Bob, and unfortunately, I didn't get to talk to you as much in the press room as I would have liked, but yeah, I don't know. I think what people see in my swing is the tempo and the rhythm, and that was pretty much a gift. I worked really hard on my swing when I was young. I started playing when I was, maybe 12-ish, played baseball and football through high school, and then kind of just stuck with golf after that.
And it kind of, you said it was a gift. It really kind of, that rhythm, that tempo came pretty naturally, Tom?
Yes, for sure. You know, I think, you know, we all have gifts, and some of them are really important gifts, like being really smart and stuff like that.
I didn't get that one. I didn't get that one.
And I got rhythm and tempo. So, but yeah, I don't know. For some reason, just when I first started, I had a real good teacher when I first started. My dad was a good player. And so I got the fundamentals pretty early. But as far as, you know, as far as what people see in my swing, that rhythm and that tempo, I was just kind of born with it. Although I can't dance worth a lick, so I'm not sure that has much to do with it. But, you know, it just, the golf swing just came really natural to me. And, you know, it was... I really like playing right away. I mean, I love baseball, probably like baseball better than I did golf when I was a kid. But, you know, I just, it was just, like I said, it was just a gift. I mean, the rhythm and tempo was just the thing.
Well, before we get into your playing career and what you're doing today, I understand you actually had a role in the movie Tim Cup.
Whoa, Bob, you're good at that. If you blinked, you would have missed my part in the movie. But we had a great time doing it. I thought it was going to propel my acting career into, you know, like Kevin Costner-ish roles, but you know, it didn't quite pan out that way. But we were in Kapalua, playing in the Kapalua Invitational, and then went straight to Houston. And we were down there. There's about maybe 10 of us. We were down there for like, I don't know, four or five, 6 days, and trying to, you know, hammer out when they were playing the Open, when Costner and those guys were playing the Open. And we all did a lot more stuff. Like Corey, I think Corey and I played, we were a twosome, and we were played, and they followed us, and they took, I don't know, rolls and rolls and rolls and rolls and rolls of film, but they ended up on the floor. So it was, all I did was we were on the range there.
Well, are you still getting residuals?
Yeah, I get about $9.85 every other month, I think it is.
Wow.
So I need everybody that's listening to, yeah, you know, to keep watching Tin Cup so I can keep getting those $10 checks.
Well, we'd offer you a job at Musings, but it would pay less than that.
Hey, right. I'm on Social Security these days, so I'm taking anything.
Hey, you mentioned about getting into the game. You grew up in Des Moines, Iowa. Obviously, you and your brother Paul, also a tour professional. Did you guys learn the game together? You mentioned about playing baseball. Did you get into it together? And you mentioned an instructor you had. How did it all kind of come together as far as starting the game, Tom?
My parents moved out to Phoenix when I was pretty young, so I didn't get to spend much time in Des Moines. It's funny, all the guys from the Midwest say, man, you're lucky your parents moved when they did. You know, we came out and, you know, back then, you know, all you had was sports. We didn't have video games and stuff like that. So my brother and I used to tag along with him and play all the sports that he did. And I had to get better really quick because he was three years older than I was. And so all his buddies were 3 years older. So, I mean, we'd go across the street and we'd play home run derby every day, all day long. And stuff like that. But as far as golf, my dad was a really good player. He was a physician and loved the game. And so he's the one that got us started. And my brother started a little bit before I did. And so, you know, being the little brother, you always want to do kind of what your older brother did. So I tagged along and got better and had fun with it. And I liked it because, you know, I could get out of it what I put into it, you know, unlike, you know, baseball and stuff, you have to play where they tell you to play and this and that. And so I was kind of my own boss. So I kind of liked that part of it and just kind of took off from there. I started when I was about 12 and, you know, just played, you know, that's what we did in the summers. After baseball, we just played every day. We were out in the golf course all day.
Did you have a PGA professional or an instructor who kind of, you know, helped shape your game, your approach to golf early on?
I did. I had a couple really good teachers when I was younger. One of the guys' name was Curly Hazeltine, and he was a PGA pro, and he taught at the club my dad was a member at. And you know, we just kind of hit it off, and that was great. And the next fellow that right after Curly was a guy by the name of Jeffrey Smith, and he was a English guy, so he was a Percy Boomer guy, and you know, real fundamental type stuff. So I was fortunate in that I had two really good teachers.
We're delighted to be joined by a very proud alumnus of Arizona State University and five-time PGA Tour winner, Tom Pertzer, here on Musings on Golf. Hey, Tom, on your Facebook page, I see a lot of great classic photos of Mr. Hogan and Gary Player and Jack and Tom Watson. Obviously, you have a great history of the game. You played with a lot of those guys as well in your career. I'm wondering if any of those players factored into how you swung at the golf ball, how you looked at the game, how you thought about golf from a mental standpoint, et cetera.
Yeah, for sure. I did. I love watching the old, you know, older swings. I love, you know, watching Mr. Hogan, Sam Snead, Jack Player, Watson, Johnny Miller. You know, those guys, and, you know, not to say anything against the equipment we have nowadays, but it was much harder to hit a ball from point A to point B than it is now. These guys, they knew what they were doing, and they were different swings. Hard to compare Hogan's and Snead's swing, but they're both, you know, very efficient. I liked Sam's swing about as much as anybody's, just because I felt like it had kind of the rhythm and the tempo that mine did. And Mr. Hogan, you know, he was a little shorter in stature, so he had to be more, his swing had to be more efficient. And it pretty much was. But I liked learning from, and I was a visual guy. I could watch somebody swing and learn from it rather than somebody telling me what, you know, how to do it. So it helped in that, you know, when I watched somebody swing, I could pick up things. So that helped a lot. But, you know, I think history is so much, and it was always fun talking. You mentioned Ben Crenshaw, and he's such a historian for the game of golf. It was so much fun being around him and listening to him talk about older players.
And you also played in a really interesting era when you had so many celebrities who were supporting PGA Tour events with their name. I mean, you had Bob Hope, you had Bing Crosby, Jackie Gleason, Andy Williams, Sammy Davis Jr. And then your first win in 77 at the Glen Campbell Los Angeles Open at Riviera, holding off Lanny Watkins by a shot. Had to be a very special week. What do you, when you think back to that win number one on the PGA Tour, what comes to mind?
Not wanting to be in a playoff with Lanny Watkins.
Yeah.
That was my, you know, I was nervous as a church mouse going that last day. I was in the last group, and you know, it was, I loved Riviera. It's probably still, you know, if it weren't for Pebble Beach, it would be my favorite course anywhere. But so I always loved the golf course. I knew it before I played. You know, I'd watch the LA Open and watch them play around there. And I just, I had a good feeling because it there was a premium on ball hitting, on, you know, on hitting the ball. What you had to, you pretty much had to use every club in your bag, and it didn't favor a fader or a hooker. You kind of had to hit all the shots. So I felt really good about the golf course even before I went. So when I got there, I loved it. It's just such a fantastic golf course. And it was hard back then, you know, the length, we still had to hit, you know, mid irons into par fours and not pitching wedges like now. But the thing about it is that I remember, you know, 11 hitting it on that green, it's par five, and hitting on that green and two. And I thought I was king of the world when I did that, because that didn't happen very often back then. Yeah. But, you know, I remember a lot of different shots there. But I remember 18 kind of pushed my drive over into the eucalyptus trees and had to cut a three iron around the trees and up on, and it got up on the hill over on the, it's a kind of an amphitheater, and on the left side of the green, there's a hill.
Sure.
So it stayed up there and had to pitch down. I had about 5 feet, and man, I was nervous. My heart was jumping out of my chest, and just thinking about, hey, if you don't make this, you're going to be in a playoff with Lanny. So we need to make this. So Lanny gave me a lot of encouragement there. Not encouragement, but determination to make that putt. Because Lanny back then was tough as nails. You know, he was a tough player and a good. We became really good friends, and he always gave me crap about that. But it was a great event. I love playing there, and you're right about all the celebrities. And I think that they all wanted to get their buddies to play in the pro-am. So that was kind of a draw for why all the guys were, all the celebrities were helping the tournaments. So it was fun. It was a fun time.
Hey, Tom, let me share with you, because I guarantee you'll get a kick out of it. I have been blessed for several years that in Houston they had the Insperity. And they would bring in Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, Lee Trevino, and, you know, every year, and Arnold Palmer. And then the first year back after Arnie had passed, it was Gary Player and Jack and I in this real little room. And I said to Gary, tell me the difference between your observations of Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer. And Gary said, oh, that's easy, Bobby. Arnie loved to play golf. Jack didn't love to play golf. And Jack's right there. Jack said, I did so, Gary. Gary said, no, you didn't, Jack. And I'm saying, here's Gary Player arguing with Jack Nicklaus, and I'm privy to the conversation. I mean, it was unbelievable, as you can well imagine, with those all-time greats getting into a discussion like that.
Yeah, they became a lot closer friends as years went on. And I think Jack loved playing golf. But Gary, in a way, Gary might have been right, I think. But, you know, Jack was just such a competitor. I don't think it would have mattered what he got into. What if it was another sport or whatever? I think he would have been tremendous at any sport. He had that mental capacity to, the will to win for him was huge. You know, I got to play with him a number of times my first few years out when he was still king of the hill. And he was just different. He just went about things differently. You know, I was just a kid out there trying to get from point A to point B, and you know, watching him, it was, you know, methodical. I mean, he didn't miss too many opportunities.
Was his was it different just in on the mental side? What was so different in being around him, being that close to him, compared to the others on tour at that time?
It was everything. I mean, just his preparation. He never let little things bother him that I could tell. Maybe inwardly he did, but you know, he just didn't pull the one thing I think about is, you know, people were on him because it took, you know, he took so long when he would hit the shot, when even before in his pre-shot routine, you know, he was going through a checklist of making sure everything was right before the club got moving, which, you know, we all can control that. And that all makes a huge difference in golf swings. but he was just so methodical about everything. I can't stress that enough. It's just, he never played a shot until he was ready. And it was, you know, and I think there's only a few players that I can think about that played golf that way. You know, Watson was a little bit like that. Obviously Tiger is a little bit like that, but, you know, he was one of a kind, really.
He certainly was that. And, my first, connection with Jack was at the 86 Masters, and I was basically there to get pre-US Open material because it was coming to Shinnecock later on that year. And after Jack's round on Thursday, which he shot a 75, I waited my turn. I was a rookie there and wasn't nearly the media that there is now. But I said, Mr. Nicklaus, you got a minute? He said, yeah. What do you want? I said, I'd like to get your impressions of the U.S. Open coming to Shinnecock in June. He said to me, U.S. Open? I'm here to win the Masters. What do you want to talk about the U.S. Open for? I said, thank you, Mr. Nicklaus, and I walked away. And that went on to be the greatest Masters ever.
Yeah, incredible. He came back and won that tournament. But that's just him. I mean, he's single-mindedness. He's so tuned in to what he's doing at the moment. And I think that's what made him better than anybody else.
Speaking of Masters, you played, I think your first one was 1977. What was that like, for the 9 zillion people that are never going to get to play Augusta, nevertheless playing the Masters? What was that like for you, Tom?
Well, you know, when you're growing up, there were two tournaments that were just huge, the Masters and the U.S. Open. And, you know, watching it, the neat thing about the Masters is you watch the same course every year. So that's what kind of set the Masters apart from the Opens and the British Opens and stuff like that, where they travel around. But so you knew these holes, you know, you knew the 12th hole, you knew the par fives and stuff. And so going there, I was a little, you know, I wasn't a little, I was way nervous. You know, that first time you drive up Magnolia Lane and you see the clubhouse and, you know, just all the people around and everything, it was daunting a little bit for a young kid from Phoenix, Arizona. And so, you know, when I go back, I would have done things a lot differently. To me, I thought the Masters was a putting contest, and it certainly isn't. I mean, it is, but it's truly a second shot golf course. It's a course where you have to put the ball in the right part of the green to have birdie putts. You'd rather have a 15 footer on one side of the cup than a 5 footer on the other side of the cup, because one, you're playing the 5 footer, you're playing defense. You're just trying to lag it, you know? And so that's important there. And I was a shy kid playing, when I first got on tour. So I didn't play practice rounds with veterans, that guys that played there and that could have given me some tips and stuff. I played with my buddies, and so I would have done that differently. And but that's probably the biggest change I would have made going there. But it's just such a beautiful golf course. You get lost in the beauty of it. And you know, one little story, Jim Colbert was a friend of mine when we got there, and he said, "Hey, I got a money game for us on Tuesday." And I go, "Okay." Well, and because I didn't, if I played for $5, that was a lot for me. So I said, "Who are we playing?" And he goes, "Well, we're playing Raymond Floyd and Dave Eichelberger." And we all know Raymond was a great player and loved to play for money. And Dave Eichelberger was the best Tuesday player on tour. I mean, he played as good as anybody on Tuesdays. He had a great career, but I mean, I'm talking really good on Tuesdays. So Colbert and I played, and I think I made three birdies on the front side, and we were one up going to the back side. And I think we were, Jim said, you know, something about we were $500 up, and I looked at him and I go, "500 what?"
Pennies, was it? One penny. Well,
yeah, exactly. So, and then we play the backside, and Eichelberger shoots 31. He has a putt on the 18th hole, a birdie putt, maybe 15 feet or something like that, for me to lose $1,800.
Oh,
and
God.
And I mean, I don't think I had $1,800 to put together. So I was praying really, really hard that he might lip it out or not, for sure not make it. And he didn't make it, thankfully. But I think I still was on the hook for about, I don't know, $400 or $500. And that kind of was a shocker to me. But, you know, it's stuff like that. When I go back and I think about playing, if I would tell somebody going out there, I would say, you know what? Don't play a practice round unless you're playing for a little something. You learn so much by playing, you know, playing for money and playing for your own money. It's huge. I would have done that differently had I gone out now versus back then.
Hey, Tom, you finished, you had some close calls in major championships. You were fourth at the 77 U.S. Open, tied for fourth, the 82 Open Championship. Any particular moment stand out from those finishes?
Well, again, like I said, the Open was huge. They were all, I loved the U.S. Open, and we were playing Southern Hills, which I really thought was a great golf course.
Yeah.
In 77. And, I hit it. That's probably, if I can think back, that's probably the best I've ever hit the ball from tee to green. Couldn't make a putt, but that's the year that Hubert won that year, and we had a he had a death threat on his life. So
yes, that's right.
On the back side, they stopped my group, and I was only in the second to last group, I think. And they kept stopping my group for 5 minutes at a time. I kept, why are they doing that? They didn't tell us that why they were slowing us down. But they kept, you know, you'd get in, you want to be in a rhythm when you're playing golf and when you're playing, especially in championships and stuff. And, I got around to the backside and I was hitting the ball great. And, you know, I kept watching Hubert and he was missing greens and getting it up and down. And I said, just be patient. You know, we're going to make some putts and see what happens. And, it was just frustrating, you know, cause I'm going, look, there's only one group behind us or whatever, you know, can't you wait until they do that after, you know, we finish? Well, let us play. And so I got up on the, I think it's a 13th hole, the par three. The wind was blowing real hard across, and I was in between a 2 and a 3 iron, and I hit this, I think I hit the 2 iron, and I got it up in the air with a little hook, and it hit the trees next to the, on the left side of the, you know, left side of the green, and kicked the ball out of bounds. So that was kind of my finish there. But I loved that. I loved the golf course, and that, you know, probably as much as anything, that would have been the tournament that I would have done best in. But then the 82 Open was at Troon. I loved Troon right away. And I had I had my caddy, and I think my caddy actually, I think he said he caddied for Arnold in the last time it was at Troon. But Jimmy was his name. And so me, that was my first British Open, and I had always left my house. I was about 30 minutes away, had plenty of time to get there. Well, as you know, Bob, the first day of the British Open is a lot different with traffic and stuff. And I got to the golf course. I left plenty early, got to the golf course 15 minutes before my tee time. I didn't get to hit any practice shots or anything. And shot 76 the first round, and then played three really, really good rounds after that. And I think I only lost by maybe a couple shots or whatever. But that, you know, I love playing the British Open because it's such a different game. You know, you've got to hit all kinds of different shots. So it's fun when you have to create shots rather than, you know, just hitting it on, you know, tee to green.
We're on our finishing holes with Tom Pertzer here on Musings on Golf. Tom, I have to ask you, you know, you talked about the difference in distances and clubs that you used back in your day versus today. And also you have LIV Golf having been such a major factor in golf for the last couple of years. Any particular thoughts on LIV Golf and any thoughts of how you might have reacted if you had been offered the kind of money that the Saudis have thrown at, you know, some pretty well-known players?
How much time we got, Kelly?
Best answer ever.
Musings, oh, baby, dear. Go to it.
You know, for me, I'm not going to say it's ruined professional golf, but it sure has put a damper in it. And I can't feel bad about the guys taking the money. It's the money that was offered to them is the issue. For me, it's all about Greg Norman. I think if somebody else would have been in control in his position, LIV Golf, I think the PGA Tour would have talked to that person. They certainly weren't going to talk to Greg. You know, Greg tried to do this in 1994, tried to take the best 40 players off of the tour. And, you know, at that point in time, he didn't have the $2 billion that he has now. And, you know, the guy said, no, we're not going to really do that because it's going to kill the tour. And, you know, now when you throw that much money in front of some young guys and guys that are on the twilight of their career, they're going to take it. You asked me what I would do. I'm a PGA Tour loyalist. So I would have liked to have thought that, I would have stayed with the tour, but at the same time, you know, I had my best year in 91. I finished fourth on the money list, and then going to 92, I hurt my back, in a little dirt bike incident, and I'd never been hurt before. So I thought, it's going to go away. It's going to go away. It never went away. And I struggled the rest of my career. I struggled with that, with a lower back issue. So, you know, it's hard to pass up $15, $20 million and even $100 million when you're the top guys. But I seriously think that, I would have liked to have thought that I would have stayed with the tour. And the guys that did stay with the tour, I gained a lot of respect for me. You know, really the only guy that I miss on the LIV tour, that went to the LIV tour, is Oosthuizen. I loved watching him swing the golf club. But the other guys, I didn't have much interest in them. With the exception, maybe Cam Smith. I thought he was a bright star. He, great player and stuff, but the other guys I could just as easy not watch. But, you know, it's disappointing, and who knows what the heck's going to happen from here on out. I never thought that the tour would, you know, do what they did. And in the manner that they did it too, that's the thing I don't get. You know, you had guys on the policy board that didn't know anything. Rory didn't know anything about it until the day of the announcement. you know, how do you not have, you know, the PGA Tour Policy Board basically controls the tour. I mean, you know, in theory, nothing happens without those four guys. I guess it's five guys now or six. Pulling, you know, they're the ones that make the decisions. So it's, you know, the live thing is really frustrating for me. And I think a lot of the tour players, I think it's frustrating. And, you know, it has caused lots of issues in that, you know, these elevated events are, you know, I'm not sure that they're good for the tour. You know, we lost the Honda's been a great sponsor for years and years and years. And, you know, how do you go to a tournament that doesn't get the elevated event and go, well, you know, you guys aren't going to get the elevated event. And there's what, I don't know, 20 of them. So a lot of those guys don't play more than that many tournaments. So you don't have a chance in getting the big names. So it's just, it caused a lot of problems, I think. And again, if it wouldn't have been a different guy in charge, I think the tour would have talked and they would have had some discussions on how they could coexist. But they certainly weren't going to do it with Greg.
Well, Tom Pertzer, on behalf of Kelly Elbins and our listeners, we say thank you for your insights, your thoughts, your honesty, and keep playing, my friend. And don't forget to make that phone call to me so we can take care of two golf courses that you will truly, truly enjoy.
I can't wait for that, Bob. And Bob and Kelly, thanks so much for having me on. It's been fun.
The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X are designed to outperform. Created in Titleist R&D laboratories, manufactured in Titleist golf ball plants, and then validated by the best players in the world. These golf balls are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with the new Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
Yeah, I really learned a lot from that interview about Tom. Really good man and historian of the game. It's always fun to hear from guys who played in that era who were around such greats as Jack and Arnold. But Tom Pertzer certainly held his own in a lot of ways.
Yeah, he really did. Very, very talented golfer. Probably a little bit unlucky that he didn't even win more.
We thank Tom Pertzer for his time. Next week, as we count down the days to the Ryder Cup, we're going to be joined by four-time European Ryder Cup captain Tony Jacklin. Cannot wait to talk to Tony and look forward to that. For my good friend Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin signing off. Thanks for joining us on Musings on Golf.